So I press the red button. The red light is on. And you just have to, you know, put it fairly close.
Okay.
So I see if it's...
Go ahead.
You want to get a drink of water?
No, it's okay. You're on.
Oh. Okay. We'll see you after dinner.
Okay.
Now, where was I the last time? Well, before I take up the chronology, I want to say a couple of things about the Anderson family. And I haven't said much about them as I went along. But there were some things of sufficient importance. Well, I'm going to backtrack a bit. Mm-hmm. In the summer of 1952, when I had just about decided to take a break from the what I saw as the ongoing treadmill that would lead me to a PhD in sociology, but would actually lead me away from the real world as I saw it. Mm-hmm. It was in that summer that I was still living at home, and my mother took me in her confidence about a letter that she had received from my Aunt Mabel, one of my father's sisters. He had three sisters, Mabel, Agnes, and Pearl. And Mabel lived in Davenport, Iowa, which is where he had been living ever since he left Palo Alto in 1937. And in this letter, my Aunt Mabel said in so many words, I never actually saw the letter, but my mother told me that Mabel was relaying the fact that my father had been seen around town going to the movies or walking in the park or whatever with this other woman. And she knew that my mother and father had not divorced, and she thought it was scandalous. And she thought my mother would also think it was scandalous. So she assumed that my mother would send an angry letter to my father telling him to stop disgracing the family and to stop seeing this woman. Well, Aunt Mabel was a member of the old school of family relations, and she assumed that my mother was also. And it's true that my mother did not believe in divorce, and in fact, she had kept nurturing the slim hope that eventually my father would come back. And she hung on to all his things in the course of several moves during the intervening years. It had been 15 years since he left. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of stuff. Not as much as I do, but still quite a lot. And so she kept it all, moving it from place to place. But Aunt Mabel did not know this aspect of my mother, which was that she was the most kind-hearted of people and the least vindictive of people. And she had no interest at all in making my father unhappy if there was any possibility that he might find happiness with somebody else. And so she composed a letter to him which, far from telling him what Aunt Mabel suggested, said to him that she had decided that he was not ever going to be coming back, and that therefore it was time for both of them to become free. And so she took it upon herself to make it look as though she were initiating the divorce, which is exactly what happened. And she could, among the causes of divorce, have said desertion, which is a universally recognized cause in all jurisdictions. But as it was, I think she probably just said irreconcilable differences, which are not fault finding.
Right.
Okay. So later on, he did marry this woman. I guess there was a waiting period required in Iowa. And after Eugene was born, and his mother and I and Jean were living on Berkeley Way, and I had started my job at the university, at the School of Public Health, my father and his new wife came out and visited us. And he was a different person. He must have been like the person that my mother had fallen in love with back at the university. No, it was at a high school in Arizona where they were both on the English department faculty. A very relaxed and, well, a fellow with a twinkle in his eye and altogether likable, unlike the unhappy man that I had known in the mid-30s when he had lost his job and was feeling inadequate by comparison with my mother, who was running this highly successful nursery school.
Right.
So the reason that I mention this is because it verified one of the things which I learned from my favorite sociology professor, Herbert Bloomer, who always insisted that human beings are changeable. And I saw that in my everyday life. And it was a good feeling that he died a happy man because he didn't have too much longer to live. I was able to visit him once before he died in Davenport and got to know him even better. But then he died from leukemia, which apparently was brought on by his lingering exposure to poison gas in World War I. Anyway, Now back to the chronology, I believe that I left off when I had thankfully, as it turned out, hopefully, I mean, I'm glad that I was turned down by the anthropologist at the University of Wisconsin or wherever it was, and did not go to Kenya because it was in the very midst of the Mau Mau Rebellion, and it would have been absolute lunacy. So I began at the University of California School of Public Health as a teaching associate, a step above a teaching assistant, where you only have to deal with a small section from a large class. In my position, I divided lectures to the entire class, which my mentor, so to speak, he called the class medical sociology. Well, in fact, it had very little to do with sociology as I had come to understand it under the guidance of Herbert Bloomer. It mostly consisted of drawing statistical relationships between certain variables like geography and age and gender and race, education, income, and certain measurements of health and well-being, or rather, illness, deaths, infant mortality, maternal mortality, and eventually longevity. Mm-hmm. As though they were causative factors, and actually they had very little to do with human interrelationships, which was what I was interested in. However, I did my best and found that I was able to do a lecture to fill up a full 50 minutes, which I hadn't been sure I could do. It was a new experience, kind of scary at first, but I got by okay with that. It was only a half-time position, and yet I was being paid more than I had been paid at the State Department of Public Health as a so-called junior public health analyst, which was just counting up births and deaths and marriages. So I was going to classes at the same time I was preparing these lectures. But even so, I found time to stay interested in other things. I found, among other things, that I was struck by the number of physicians who had become writers. And there were a number of other writers who were not physicians, but who wrote about the world of health and medicine. So it struck me to maybe prepare an anthology to be called The Healing Arts in Literature, or something like that. Because I had library privileges which entitled me as a sort of quasi-member of the faculty to roam in the stacks at will and to check out as many books as I might want. And I'm afraid I abused that privilege, because there came a time when my mentor got an irate call from some member of the library staff, thinking that I was engaged in some illegal or immoral activity with all of their books. I had over 100 books checked out at one time. I still have those excerpts typed up somewhere. Well, this was a 2-year appointment, and along about April of the second year, Dr. Rogers, which was his name, said to me one day, "It's about time that you begin lining up your ducks in order." I guess an allusion to the in an amusement park, there's a game where they have ducks on an endless belt, and you're given a rifle of some kind to try to pick them off. Anyway, what in fact were my possible ducks? At that point, I was in line to get a second master's degree, one in a social science, and the other in an applied science or health science, whatever you might want to call it, a profession, supposedly different from the academic profession. In other words, I could have returned to the Department of Sociology either at Stanford or in the department at Berkeley, where Dr. Bloomer was now the chairman. But I wanted to do something outside of the main track, and began trying to figure something that would call jointly upon these two master's degrees in somewhat well, I had somewhat tried to do that same thing in my application for the research in Kenya, which would have called upon my experience in the State Department of Public Health, even though I had no academic training in it. But now that I did have the academic training, I returned to the concept of folk medicine in a society that is coming into contact with Western medicine and to see what happens. As I have mentioned before, I was always more interested in social change than in social stability. Now, my wife at that time was David's mother, who went by the name of Pam, and I will call her that because that's what she was called by everybody at that time. She had spent a year in Ecuador, where her father, who was a colonel in the army, was a military attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Quito. And Pam took the children with her.
All right.
Okay.
Was there some way that this could be put on pause?
No, that wasn't worth it.
Okay.
Edit it out. So she, how old was she when?
Actually, they.
When she.
I may be confused as to the timing of all this. In any case, the three children all learned Spanish, including Pam, who was the youngest of the three. And so between the two of us, we tried to figure out some kind of research problem that would call upon her knowledge of that language and my background in both sociology and health. And we hit upon the idea that there were a number of Mexican farm workers who came up from Mexico with a background in the folk medicine of that country. And while they were in this country, they may have been exposed in one way or another with Western-style medicine, because they probably did not have access to folk healers in this country of the type to which they were perhaps accustomed. So then when they went back to Mexico, did they carry with them a memory of and perhaps preference for what they learned about Western style medicine, and thereby reflected a form of social change, which may have rubbed off on their colleagues who hadn't been to this country. It was a very, very tricky subject, full of variables that would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to statistically control. But I was so anxious to find a research problem that I could get funded that I was willing to stick my neck out. But here's the kicker. I didn't know anything about farm labor. All I knew was that I had read in certain exposés that there was a problem of illegal immigrants, or as they were called in the popular press, wetbacks. So I proposed to somehow or other try to find a large sample of wetbacks who would represent the experimental group. And the control group would consist of people in Mexico who had never been to this country. And all of this was supposed to take place back in Mexico itself. On the theory that to try to interview them in this country would be virtually impossible because they were here illegally and would be afraid that we gringos were all representing the government.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, everything hinged upon my being able to carry it on in Mexico itself. So I did a good deal of research on the different parts of the country that were agriculturally based, and eventually found that a lot of agriculture took place in a state called Michoacán, which happened to be at an elevation where the climate was quite salubrious and one was not likely to get malaria as one might at a lower elevation, and it was, in other words, a nice spot for a family. So that was the aim. And I drew up a research proposal and learned, in fact, I probably knew in advance, that Dr. Rogers sat on one of the committees of the National Institutes of Health, which was the government agency that funded research in all kinds of different areas, and many of the institutes were devoted to one particular type of illness. There was a National Cancer Institute. There was a National Institute of cardiovascular conditions. There was a National Institute of Mental Health. And then there was a kind of a catch-all institute. I can't remember the exact name. Institute of Community Health, something like that, quite vague. And that's the one that Dr. Rogers was a member of. And so he was among those who met twice a year, or I don't know, maybe three times a year, and passed judgment upon proposals for studies. So I submitted this proposal to his group. Now, for the sake of appearances, of course, he had to recuse himself when it came time to voting upon my application. But all of the other members of the committee knew that this proposal had his blessing. And that, of course, is how things get done in the wonderful world of bureaucracies. Sometimes it works in your benefit and sometimes it doesn't. In this case, it did. We're talking about my application for a study, which later became a study of Bracero health, but at the time, I was so ignorant about the facts of agricultural life that I thought all of the Mexican farm workers in California were here illegally and were known as wetbacks. And in fact, I even used this term in my application, being so dumb that I didn't know that among Spanish people it's a dirty word. It's as though I had used the N-word. Mm-hmm. But everybody else in the whole system was so dumb that they didn't know that. And so they approved it. And oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Fortunately, there were some people in the faculty at UC, particularly including a grand old man named Paul Taylor, who had done pioneering work in farm labor back in the 20s and 30s, who enlightened me to the fact that most Mexican farm workers in California were no longer illegal, but were so-called braceros who were here under contracts. All perfectly legal. And there were still some domestic Spanish-speaking and even a few domestic English-speaking farm workers. But more and more and more of them were being imported under these contracts. So I had to begin educating myself under this system. And here, once again, a friend of Pam's from Stanford, his name was Paul DiCarli, suggested that I talk to his mother, who was a social worker in Stockton, who knew a good deal about farm labor in that area and might have some ideas about how I should proceed. And she in turn referred me to a Catholic priest in Stockton, who was deeply involved in the farm labor situation, because he had a special dispensation from his bishop to spend full time among the Spanish-speaking, and particularly among braceros. And his name was Thomas McCullough, and he became one of the great influences in my life. He may have introduced me to a colleague of his named Father McDonald, who was based in San Jose. In any case, I met him before very long, and he was also extremely influential in my thinking. And Father McCullough introduced me to a young woman in Stockton who was very active in an organization called the CSO, standing for Community Service Organization, which was a private group set up by a man in Chicago named Saul Alinsky, who believed in a certain type of community organization, community organizing, based upon beginning very small with house meetings and finding out what people really were concerned about, rather than imposing it from above. And the young lady that Father McCullough introduced me to was Dolores Huerta, who later became quite well known. At the time, she was very young and pretty and full of pep, and she was interested in helping my study in any way that she could. So I began drafting a questionnaire, because braceros would come into the office of the CSO with problems of various kinds, and she would try to help them as best she could, and she still had energy left over to volunteer to interview braceros as they came in with this questionnaire about health and their attitudes toward health and their ideas about what one should do if one had a pain in the intestines or a pain in the throat or whatever. I can't remember. The whole thing was very crude at the beginning. One of them, I remember one of the questions got into the subject of venereal disease, which raised a question as to whether she would feel uncomfortable asking a man anything in this area, but she had absolutely no qualms about it. That woman was fearless, as she later proved in many ways. So I was struggling with the whole approach, and before long it became apparent that I needed to move away from the Bay Area to an area where there were more braceros close by. And for various reasons, I looked into the facilities in Claremont, which is where I had gone to college, although I hadn't been there. During the interim, I graduated in 49, and we're now talking about the spring of 57. Well, one of the two sociology professors that I had been quite close to was now the chairman of the department. The old chairman had retired, although he was still in town. There were newcomers to the department, including some young fellows who happened to have an interest in Mexico, and I learned a good deal from them, and I was given access to office machinery in the Department of Sociology, and the whole thing just looked beautiful. And they had, since I had been there, they had built a large library which brought together all of the Claremont colleges. And there were several in Claremont. There was Scripps College, there was Claremont Men's College, there was Pitzer College, and I can't even remember all of them. It was based upon the so-called Oxford Plan, in which each of the colleges was independent in many ways, and yet they served, they had certain facilities and personnel in that they shared. So it was there that the third and last of my children with Pam was born. On the drive to the nearest Kaiser Hospital, she was born in the car. Mm-hmm. Now, the nearest Mexican consulate was in San Bernardino. A little bit closer than Los Angeles. In any case, I didn't have to worry about the traffic in San Bernardino. So I submitted to them an application for a visa for the purpose of going down into Michoacán to conduct scientific research. And of course, I had to describe it in some detail. While I was waiting for a reply, I busied myself with research in the library at Claremont, which was quite well stocked with materials relevant to my interests. For example, they had an excellent supply of the records of congressional hearings. And every time that the Bracero program came up for discussion in Congress, which it did every year or two, it needed more funding for the Department of Labor to administer the Bracero program. And at these congressional hearings, there were always witnesses from the growers' side who claimed that they had to have the program or else they would all have to go out of business. And then there were a few always from the labor side who argued that it was depriving American workers of their rightful jobs and so forth. So they had all these hearings in the library there, and I studied them. Copied a lot of the material. And waited. I began visiting some Bracero camps in the area. There were quite a few within easy driving distance, and found a number of camp managers who were very happy to have me inspect their facilities, and some of them weren't bad at all. But of course, I was not able to communicate directly with the Braceros themselves, since I didn't have any grasp of the language. This is worth mentioning. I began trying to study Spanish with Bam as my tutor. And I learned that it's not a good idea to try to study with somebody with whom you're emotionally involved any more than it's a good idea to become financially involved with some. It's not a good idea to lend money to loved ones. Because Pam naturally thought that I should apply myself and work hard at it. And I felt she was being unnecessarily hard on me. And so we had our differences of opinion and eventually gave up the effort for me to learn the language that way. I don't know how I thought I was going to learn it. If I had gone down to Michoacan still with almost no grasp of the language at all. However, eventually the letter came through from the consulate saying in Spanish that it was not possible for me to get a visa for the purpose that I had mentioned. I had a part-time secretary by then who was able to translate it for me, and that was that. There was no avenue of appeal. And I had to rethink the entire project. I began to interview Spanish-speaking persons in the area. As interviewers, with the thought that they would be going into the Bracero camps and that we would find plenty of informants there, since I seemed to be having no difficulty getting the cooperation of the managers of some of these camps. I gave a number of people trials using early drafts of the questionnaire, but most of them dropped out. A few were sufficiently interested in the subject that they then took it upon themselves to do studies of their own. A couple of the fellows were graduate students at the Claremont Graduate School. And in that way, I had an effect upon other people that was rather gratifying. Because one of the things that I learned as I went along feeling my way, I could hardly believe it, and yet it seemed to be true everywhere I went, that there was this large program involving altogether hundreds of thousands of men every year that very few people knew about, and that nobody other than I was trying to study. Although it seemed to me that the field was ripe for people in various disciplines, not only sociology, but politics and economics. And anthropology and history and so forth. Nobody was studying it in any place that I could find. And that continued to be true no matter how far I traveled in the attempts to find somebody with whom I could talk about what they were doing, what they were finding, and trying to tell them what I was finding. But it was very lonely. Then I can't remember the exact date, but I found that there was a so-called reception center for braceros outside of the town of El Centro in the Imperial Valley of California. One of three reception centers at or near the border of the U.S. and Mexico, through which there were streams of prospective braceros who were being funneled through from what were called migratory stations in the interior of Mexico. There was one near the Pacific coast at a little town called Empalme, through which prospective braceros began, and they were screened in various ways at that point. And those who passed those screens were sent to El Centro, through which they went through a couple or three more screens. And then they were sent to all of the bracero users in California and Arizona and Oregon and Washington. So I interviewed the manager of that El Centro reception center and told him that I was working under a grant from the National Institutes of Health and that I was interested in studying Bracero's ideas about health and sickness. And he had no objection to that. Well, I guess he said, knowing how these things work, I'm pretty sure he must have said that he didn't personally have any problem with it, but he would need to get in touch with the people above him. And there were several layers. One of them was in San Francisco, and then there was another layer in Washington, D.C. Probably several in between there that I can't even remember. Well, this seemed like a good way to solve the problem of methodology. With the one exception that I wouldn't be interviewing any men who had no experience at all with the U.S. and the U.S. ways of doing things. However, there would be some who were coming into this country for the first time, whose only experience would have been these brief physical exams that they received and blood test and chest x-ray that they were given at El Centro. And I didn't think that would contaminate the before and after comparisons too badly.
Mm-hmm.
At least I hoped so. Now, I guess I have not been altogether forthcoming. In the time between my meeting with Thomas McCullough, which probably took place about October of 1956. I didn't receive my MA, I mean my MPH, until September of 56. So my studies, my research couldn't have begun before that, I think. Anyway, beginning with that profound meeting with Father McCullough, and the time that I got turned down by the consulate in San Bernardino, I had seen enough and heard enough and talked to enough people that I had formed definite opinions about what I called the Bracero system, because it seems to me that to call it a program was rather benign, and it made it sound like a vaccination program or something else with a legitimate social purpose. And in fact, it seemed to me that it was a system which served a conglomeration of economic interests, all of them on one side of the scale. It involved the entire apparatus of corporate agriculture, family farmers didn't use braceros, they did most of the work themselves or had family members helping them, or in a few cases year-round hired men. It was a program largely of benefit to industrialized agriculture. And as part of their system, they seemed to have friends among the government agencies that were supposed to be administering the program, or the system, as I called it. It was administratively lodged within the U.S. Department of Labor, which, according to its congressional charter, dating all the way back to 1915, it was supposed to advance the interests of American working men. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination the Bracero system could be said to advance the interests of American working men. I didn't think it was even advancing the interests of Mexican working men, but that's another subject. In December of 56, fairly soon after I met Father McCullough, I met another very, very influential man on my thinking, named Ernesto Galarza, who had a PhD in social economy or some such general field. He was very knowledgeable about all of the social sciences. And devoted most of his adult life to try to organize a farm workers' union. He lived in San Jose. And I found him absolutely mesmerizing. Very brilliant speaker in public or in personal conversation. Brilliant writer. He was very much the way I wanted to be. I tried to keep my personal feelings out of the research. The wording of the questions didn't have anything to say about how they were treated on the job or anything of that sort. Although in keeping with what I considered to be perfectly legitimate research practice, there was at the very end an opportunity for them to expand on anything that they wanted to related to the subjects that we had covered. Mm-hmm. And when it came time for me to interview people who might possibly become my interviewers, I tried not to express my personal feelings to them. I dare say that it's not altogether possible to disguise strong feelings by your tone of voice and your facial expressions or gestures, but I tried to impress upon them the fact that we were trying to get an objective answer to the question underlying all this had nothing to do with whether the Bracero system was good or bad. We were trying to get at a perfectly legitimate question of whether exposure to Western medicine is having an effect upon the third world. That's what it boils down to. So, we went along still trying to get a full-time interviewer or two. And eventually I did. I found a fellow who lived in Calexico, which is on the border right across from Mexicali, a little bit south of El Centro. He had been a shoe salesman in Calexico. And had lost his job because the local people were no longer buying shoes. Because their jobs were being taken over by braceros. And if braceros needed shoes, there were guys who would drive around from camp to camp selling shoes out of the trunks of their cars. So Louis needed a job, and I found he was very good at getting people to open up. And so I hired him, and he began interviewing guys who were at this El Centro reception center waiting for their chest x-ray or waiting for their blood to be drawn for a syphilis test or waiting to be loaded onto a bus to be driven to their place of employment or whatever. Hey.
Noah and I have to go.
Well, it's already 6:45.
You get a good stopping point?
I think so.
All right. Okay. So we press the red button.